You know, this evening I would like you people to realize that we have a gentleman as a speaker who goes to great lengths for his sobriety. And at this time I should like to introduce to you Jack B. from New York.
Good evening, friends. My name is Jack Brennan. I'm an alcoholic. I have attended many, many conferences, and I have only seen one conference that the mayor did show up. And the only reason he showed up, he was the chairman of the meeting. I think that it would be a fine idea to invite the police chief. I would like to whisper in his ear, what would you do if they all got drunk, Chief? It certainly is a pleasure to be here tonight. This morning I didn't think I was going to make it. See, I have to take a deep breath in New York and hold it till I get here. And this morning I had a little turmoil. I couldn't get American Airlines. I had to get TWA. And I missed that big AA on the coffee cups, you know. When I see that, I feel quite secure. But I would like to tell you people what it was that arranged for me to come out here. I appreciate it. Because I'm here, there's one individual sitting out there that has to hear what I have to say. Now, I'm not quite stupid, you know. I don't think that everybody here is going to stop drinking because I arrived. I don't believe that. But I do believe that AA is a God-given and God-inspired program. And I do believe that the reason that I'm here tonight is for one sick alcoholic. And whatever I say here tonight will help him. Will help him as my life was changed by AA too. So whoever that sick alcoholic is, listen, please. Because that's one hell of a trip from New York, you know. The rest of you can sit there quietly. And you see, I'm a very happy fellow. A lot of people don't think so. A lot of people say to me, are you sleeping? I'm not really sleeping. I just sit there and listen, you see. I can learn more by listening than I can by yapping. And a lot of people say, I remember years ago, my wife was in New Jersey with me, and she always sat at the table down one end. You see, I don't see good, and I don't hear good. And that causes a lot of confusion in people's lives, too. They're talking at me, and I don't answer. And they wonder what the hell's wrong with me, you see. But anyway, I was sitting at the table this night, and I'm watching my wife, and kind of listening to what she's saying by looking at her. And one of the women said, is he always so quiet? And she said, yeah, he's always quiet. Well, doesn't he ever get excited? She said, no. And don't he ever get upset when he has to talk in front of so many people? She said, well, I tell you something, he's half blind, so he don't know how many people are here. She said, he's too stupid. If somebody told him he's too stupid anyway, he would never get excited. So that's me. I'm the big shot speaker from New York. I was in the men's room one night and I heard some guy say, who we got tonight? Huh? Some big shot from New York. I met him after the meeting. He almost dropped it. He almost dropped dead when he saw me. He said, I'm going to tell you one story, and then I'm going to get on with my story because we're kind of pushed a little bit here for time. But I always like to tell you, just to prove to those people that doubt that I'm alive, that I have a good sense of humor, too. And I could stand here and I could keep you laughing all night, but that's not why I'm here. It's people get paid for that on TV. But I will tell you one story, and it concerns a little Irishman in Ireland, of course. Where else would you find an Irishman? And his wife went up to the rectory, and she rang the bell, and she said, oh, my God, Father, he's drunk again. And the priest says, oh, no. And she said, yes, it's true. And she was crying and tearing on. And the priest says, well, I don't know what we're going to do. I really don't. He would just get him sober, and he's drunk again. He said, that's terrible. He said, well, we've tried everything with him. We tried feeding him and coaxing him and begging him. And we tried praying with him. We tried everything. Let's now, you know, he said, how about we try and scare him? He said, you know, Mary, he said, that little house that you live in is at the end of the lane. And on either side of that lane is a bunch of bushes and trees. And he says, I'll tell you what you do. He says, tonight, he said, when you think he's coming home, you get out there in the bushes. And you put a big sheet over your head. And when he gets near you, you scare him. Jump out and scare him. Tell him you're the devil. So here's this poor soul. She's out there around midnight, you know, waiting for himself to come home. And here he comes down the lane, hitting both sides and singing. And she waits till he gets about 10 foot in front of her, and she jumps out and waves her arm in a big sheet. And she says, I'm the devil, I'm the devil. And he rears back and he says, oh, let me shake your hand. I married your sister. Well, that's the end of the nonsense. Now we get down to the nitty-gritty. My name is Jack Brennan. I'm an alcoholic. And I don't much care what my name is, but I'm very damn sure glad and happy that I know that I'm an alcoholic. That's the most important thing that I ever learned in my life, and I don't ever want to forget it. Because I suffer from a very real physical disease, chemical in nature, very similar to diabetes. And my disease affects me, and it manifests itself in me in three various ways. It manifests itself in me physically in that I'm incapable of eating or sleeping or doing anything when I'm drinking. It also affects me mentally in that it causes me to be able to do things that I normally wouldn't want or couldn't do unless I were drinking. And the third manifestation of my disease is spiritual. And I would define for you now the word spiritual, having nothing whatsoever to do with religion or church. A spiritual individual in my book is simply an individual who is wanted and needed and loved in this world. By his actions, he's wanted, needed, and loved. And you can readily see how an alcoholic is not needed, not wanted, and not loved. So he's a very unspiritual individual. So now I suffer from a disease of alcoholism that affects me in these three areas, manifests itself in me. And one of these three areas are affected. It's my disease that's at work. Now I've learned this since I came into AA. And it was very important that I know this because I was an individual like so many alcoholics today. They walk about the world with 2 feet firmly planted in midair. And that's about the name of the game here. Because you come into AA and you learn what's wrong with you. And it's no longer a question that maybe you shouldn't drink. If you know that you suffer from a disease, and it's a very real disease, then you know it's just damn well a question that you just can't drink, period. And that makes one big difference. Because for years I heard people talking about willpower and the lack of religion and weak-willed people. And I have a suggestion for anybody that thinks that this might be a question of willpower. The next time that you have diarrhea, you try willpower. You see, I was born an alcoholic, and right here I lose half of the audience because they say, well, I wasn't. Well, that don't make no damn difference because, you see, some people are born with the disease of alcoholism and some, due to the chemical imbalance that we suffer from, come into AA or have trouble with alcohol much later, so it makes little difference. If you were born an alcoholic, or you're an alcoholic later, or your sex, or your age, or your color, has nothing whatsoever to do with it. I have never yet heard a discussion between two diabetics, but you're over who is the biggest diabetic. They're very happy to know that they got a disease. But I've also never seen a diabetic go down the wrong side or the wrong direction on an expressway at 90 miles an hour. But I have seen alcoholics do that, you see. So our disease, while it's chemical in nature, the same as diabetes, it's more spectacular in that it causes us to do things that are insane. But it only causes us to do them when we're drinking. The medical profession knows today that the alcoholic returns to sanity when the alcohol leaves the system. So why I'm standing here tonight is to reassure some individuals sitting out there, you are not crazy. You are not crazy. And I can prove it to you. In New York, there's a very fine psychiatrist. He's the head of the Nassau County Division of Mental Health. And some years ago, about eight, I found this poor individual suffering from the disease of alcoholism, unemployable, washing dishes for a living. And now 8 years later, he's in AA, and he's quite sober and quite happy. And he's the chief psychiatrist for mental health department in Nassau County, Long Island. So if you want to know anything about whether this is a disease or a mental illness, you call him up and ask him. He'll tell you about it. Well, I was born like everybody else. There has been quite an argument about that over the years. But I did have a mother and I did have a father. And I knew both of them quite well. And for a long time, I think about 6 months, they were very happy they had a new son. It was quite apparent from the beginning there was something different with this one. Now, I was one of nine children. And I'm the only alcoholic among the children. But you see, my life was different from the very beginning. And the doctors tell us now that there is a child that is predisposed toward alcoholism. In other words, he has a chemical imbalance that will, when he reaches alcohol, he will find a relief in it that a normal person won't find. And he will find a relief from ungrounded and unfounded fear. Now, I was born with ungrounded and unfounded fear. And they couldn't call me an alcoholic because as yet I hadn't drank. But they knew there was something wrong with me because I reacted completely different than the other eight kids in the family. They went to school and they lived a very normal life, I would say. And they grew up and got good marks in school. And they did just exactly as you would expect of a child. But me, I was different. I was always a round block in a square hole. And I was always afraid. And I was afraid to go to school. I was afraid to play baseball, football. I was afraid to answer a question in school. If the teacher would ask me a question, I wouldn't answer for fear that I might be wrong and someone would laugh at me. And I had to sleep with a light on when I went to bed. And my brothers and sisters made a great deal of fun about that. And the more fun they poked at me, the more I retired into myself. And it got to the point where I couldn't do anything. I couldn't have any part of a family relation with my family. I was different, period. That was it. And I couldn't wait to grow up. And I had an alcoholic for a father, only in those days we didn't call him alcoholic. We called him a dirty bum, depending on who was looking at him and who was talking. If the priest would look at him, he would tell him that he should pray more, go to church more. And if the psychiatrist or doctor looked at him, he would say, well, he's quite an interesting case, you see. And it depended on who was looking at who and who was doing the talking as to what label they had for my father. But I always looked at him with a great deal of love and hope. I loved him very dearly, and I hoped that one day he would stop drinking, as he promised. And you know, that day never came because there was no AA for my father. It was before Bill Wilson. And it was before that the higher power gave this program to Bill Wilson. So my father never had a chance to be sober. And I used to look at him and ask him and beg him and plead with him, please don't drink. And he would say, I won't. And I know now that he meant what he said. But you see, about 2 weeks later, he would forget the agonies of the last drunk. And maybe it was the pressures of the world without AA. And he would pick up a drink just like everybody else on the way home from Waco, and he wouldn't get home. And my father again would be drunk, and I would be thrown into terror. And I say terror, because I loved my father, and yet when he drank, I hated him. Because my mother was a very beautiful woman, and I loved her very dearly, and all I wanted in this world was to take care of my mother. I wanted to grow up and get a nice little house somewhere and live with her. And I wanted to buy her all the dresses that she never had, and I wanted to watch her go to a supermarket or store and be able to buy any cut of meat that she wanted, you see, because she never had that opportunity. My father's drinking and 9 kids in the family. We were always scratching for what to eat. I never had a new pair of shoes or a pair of skates or a bicycle until I grew up and I stole them for me. But there was no money. And it was due to my father's drinking, and yet no one would talk about my father's drinking. We hid him. We buried him. We made out that he was dead. And then when he would come back to life and be sober for a week, everybody would be very happy, and the money would start to come in again, and we'd be climbing out of the hole a little bit, possibly, and suddenly there we went again back into the pits. It didn't affect my brothers and sisters, but it certainly affected me, because I'm an alcoholic, and I see these things, and I hated booze. I hated booze with a passion. And when anyone would bring booze, I would curse them, you know, to myself. They would bring alcohol into the house, and I knew that my father and alcohol were trouble. And I just couldn't understand why people did it. So you see, for me to stand here and tell you that I'm an alcoholic is actually ridiculous, unless that you take into consideration that I do have a very real disease. It's not just a question that I shouldn't drink. It's a question that I can't drink, period. Now, when I was 12 years old, I was put into a bedroom with my brother. I was put into the bedroom because my father had started on another drunk. And by this time, at 12, I didn't speak to anyone in the home. I didn't talk to my brother because my older brother, I was always told to be like him. And I couldn't be like him. He was a good, fine boy. And he was not an alcoholic. And he went to school, and he got fine marks, and everybody liked him, and he always combed his hair. He hung his clothes up, and he even went to church when it wasn't Sunday. And for me to try to be like him, I failed miserably. And so I tried to be like my brother, and then I couldn't, and I hated him. You see, he had been in John for 37 years before he died. My average was about 37 jobs a year. So we were absolutely, completely two different people. And yet I was constantly told, be like your brother, or be like Tommy McGrath down the street, or be like this boy who was the head of the class, and I was not able to do that. So always failing, and always failing, and always falling down. As much as I would try, I just stopped trying. And I took an attitude to hell with everybody. And when I get big, I'm going to straighten everything out. So I sat and I waited and straightened everything out. Well, in this bedroom, this particular day, my brother came up from under the bed with a gallon jug of wine. And he said, Jack, let's have a drink. And I said, well, you have a drink. Because, you see, my mother didn't raise any stupid children. And I wanted to see what was going to happen before I took one. Well, he took a drink and he said, it's nice, it's sweet, and it's good. Try it. And I tried it. And that drink changed my life. Because you see, with my chemical body that I have, alcohol, the first time that I got to it, the first drink that I ever swallowed, relieved me of the ungrounded and unfounded fear that I had lived with for 12 years. I don't believe until that moment I ever knew a happy day. I was always concerned about something. When Christmas came, I would disregard Christmas completely. To me, it was just another drunk or a time for worrying that would my father get drunk and fall into the tree, or wouldn't he? So I had no happy days until 12 years of age. And when I took my first drink of wine, I experienced what all alcoholics experience. In fact, it's what makes us alcoholics. It's not what you drink or how much. It's what that it does to you that makes you an alcoholic. So I could sit down right now, I've finished talking actually, because my brother, when I asked him to take a second, when he did, and I did, and I felt even better than I had before, and then when I asked him to take a third, he said, no, no more, that's enough. And some 40 years later, now if you got to Lynbrook, Long Island, and you drink with my brother, he'll do exactly the same thing to you. He'll give you the first drink and the second drink, then he'll put the cork in the bottle and the bottle back in the closet. He's all finished and you just lit the fire. Well, that's what he did to me 40 years ago. And I begged him to take a third one. He said, no, I don't want it. If you drink any more of that, you're going to get sick. Put it back and put it under the bed and forget about it. And I said, no. And I said, if the Lord made anything better than this, he must have kept it up there. And, you know, I drink on that bottle, and I remember maybe 3 or 4 or 5 drinks. And I tell you something, I don't remember any further. Next morning, my mother was bending over me crying. And I asked her, Mom, what's the matter? I woke up very startled. And I had in my feeling, that feeling in the pit of my stomach that's peculiar to the alcoholic, remorse. Didn't know what I had done, but I knew something was wrong. And I tried very rapidly to think of what I had done. I couldn't. It was a blackout. And my mother said, Jack, for the love of God, don't ever do again what you did last night. And I said, what did I do? And she said, you drink almost 3/4 of a gallon of wine. And then you passed out in a bathtub trying to take a bath. She said, Jack, one in this family is enough, please. And I promised her with the bottom of my heart that there'd be no more. And you know, I was lying. Because anything that made me feel as good as booze made me feel, I was not about to give up. So I looked at that woman that I loved so dearly, and I told her, Mom, there will be no more. Please stop crying, and it will never happen again. I don't know what happened. It's just a mistake. Please stop crying. And she said, all right, I will. And don't ever do that again. And I said, I will. And you know, it didn't hurt me at all to lie to her. Because I knew that explanations were no good. I couldn't explain to her that I was going to drink, but I did. You see, I was an Irish Catholic. And if you're an Irish Catholic and you're an altar boy, you can drink. And I got the 5 o'clock mass, the 6 o'clock mass, you know. And I asked for it, and I got there at 5:15. And I had me some of the best drinks I ever had in sacristies. And you know, they go first class in them sacristies, too. And every once in a while, I would run across an alcoholic priest, and he would get there 4:45, see? And that would shoot my day right there. He would... Because you see, if I had a drink before I went to school, I could answer questions. In fact, many times I would tell a nun, sit down, sister, I'll take over the class today. But if I met one of them peculiar priests, you know, that got there 4:25, that was a bad day for me, because I would sit in the back of the room again like Vinnie the Dunce, like just like before. So all my life, I was 12 years old and scared. I never knew a day without being 12 years old and scared until I came to AA. Because, you know, you can't stay in a state of suspended animation. You can't possibly drink 24 hours a day. You have to sleep. And when I slept, I woke up, I was always back to being a 12-year-old scared kid again. So my morning drink started very early. Started very early because I hated that 12-year-old scared kid. That kid wasn't capable of anything. And you see, in my distortion, in my mind, the mental manifestation of my disease, it caused me to do things that normally I wouldn't think of doing. So I ran at a very early age, age 16, my mother threw me out of the house. And she threw me out of the house because I brought home a gun, and I brought home a bottle of whiskey, and I brought home a roll of stolen money. I was convinced that work was for horses and fools. My father worked like a pig, and he got as dirty and tired as any man could get, and I had no shoes, and I said, the hell with work. So for years, I took what I wanted. I took what I wanted, wherever I could get it, and I hurt an awful lot of people. and have stolen an awful lot of money in my time. I ran with a mob down on the west side of New York. And I'm not very proud of what I tell you here tonight, but it tells me in AA that I tell you what it was like and what I did and what it's like now, so that's what I must do. I don't ever want to forget the past. I want to keep that right in front of my eyes all the time because it makes me so grateful and I'm able to come to AA as nasty as I was and be accepted. You see, because I was not satisfied with stealing someone's money, I would probably bash them across the bridge of their nose with a gun too. Now, I don't like anyone to get the impression that I tell you these things because I like it. I don't. It took me many, many years in AA to be able to bury my past. And I say, thank God for AA and the new way of life that it is. Because the things that I think about sometimes now, especially when the moon is up like it is now too, I sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and I'm back to being what I used to be years ago in my dreams, nightmares. And it's these nights that I appreciate AA. I appreciate AA so much. Because it's allowed me to bury my garbage. It doesn't stink quite so badly now. When anything is useful, it doesn't smell too badly. So I can stand the stink of me now, but I couldn't when I came into AA. Now, I lost my first job on account of drinking. And my first job was a real man for a mom. And I was a good real man, you see. But you know how the alcoholic is. He wakes up in the morning, he's 12 years old and scared, and he don't remember quite what happened the night before. And you go down and you start asking those stupid questions, you know. Like, how did it go last night? And they would look at me in horror, and they would say, don't you know you drove the car? And I would say, well, I was kind of busy. You see, my name is, in New York, they used to call me Crazy Jack the Embriago. Crazy Jack the Drunken. And well, I drove a car real well, you know, and I've shot people, and I've been shot, too. And I've driven cars at 90 miles an hour, getting away from cops, from all kinds of nasty people in the back of me. And I don't beg about it, but that's the way that it was. And yet, these same people called me in one day, and they told me, Jack, you drink too much. And we're afraid that we can't use you anymore. And they said, you know, someday you might take us to a police station instead of taking us home. You don't remember too good. And of course, I denied it, but they were right. They were absolutely right. Because I remember when I used to wake up and I used to reach out and smell my gun first to see if it had been fired. And then I would reach in my pocket and see if I had any money. And then I would reach under the bed and I would take a big drink to bury that kid that I was, 12 years old and scared. Well, I tell you that the alcoholic is two people. He's two people just exactly like that. One hiding behind the other. And the one that we have to cover up the 12-year-old scared kid is the one that we create with alcohol. And we become what we think people want us to be. Or we try so hard to be like the other guy and we can do it with booze. As you see, when I came into AA, I was still 12 years old and scared. I was a big man. A big man and with a kid's mind and a kid's heart. And what happened to me after this is very, very nasty and indeed. Because they fired me from my job and I went out on my own and I got in a lot of trouble. I've been arrested over 125 times. And it's not nice to stand up before a judge and not know what you've done. Stand there and listen, and they accuse you of this and that, and you can't do anything but agree, because you don't know. And these times that I was standing there with no recollection of what had happened, with remorse filling my belly, it's the times that I wish that I had never ever picked up a drink. And I would mentally make notes that this has got to be the end, there is something wrong. I was not born to live the life that I was living. And I was going to change. But the moment I got out of the scrape that I was in, I found that a 12-year-old kid is not wanted anywhere. Nobody needs him, nobody wants him, and nobody loves him, especially when he's a 12-year-old kid with a body of a man. So my time was spent wishing that I had never been born and hoping to God that some night that I would be killed. And this is the way that it was, and then I got married. I went away to sea shortly after I got married because I couldn't stand the look that my wife gave me when I got up in the morning and took a drink. And she would say, "Jack, you know, it's enough that we had last night, we were out, and now why are you out so early in the morning?" And I would say, "Well, I just need one." But you see, I never ever wanted to be called an alcoholic. I never wanted anybody to know that I was so dependent on booze. I never wanted anybody in this world ever to think that I was like my father. My father was a drunken bum. I was different. I had money. It was other people's money, but I didn't care. I was not a drunken bum like my father. And I fought right down to the bottom. I couldn't go any lower, trying not to be an alcoholic in spite of all the conditions. Well, I left home and I went to sea because things were getting hot for me in New York and Massachusetts and Connecticut, all over. I was wanted everywhere I went. I had been in trouble and jumped bail in many places and got out, and I was having one hell of a time trying to make a living, stealing. And along the way, people used to try to help me. And they would come into where I'd be sitting in a court or in jail, and priests and ministers and social workers, and they say, "You're such a nice young fellow. Now we're going to help you." And I would just look at them with one eye, and I would say, "Yeah, I know. The first thing that I have to do is stop drinking, right?" And they say, "That's right." And I would say, "Well, I can't. So you can stop right now and leave. I don't need any help." Because I was firmly convinced that there was no way in this world to live without drinking. Because if I didn't drink, I was that 12-year-old kid. And who the hell needs a 12-year-old kid? So there was no way in this world that I knew that I was doomed. When I left home and went to sea, my wife was quite upset. And I told her, "Well, it's better this way because I'm too hot here in New York." She never knew exactly what I did, but I said, "I can't get a job, and I'll go to sea." And I was doing all right, really, until one day I found myself swimming, and I don't swim. And I didn't know what had happened. And I asked the guy next to me if I could hold on to his life jacket, and I asked him what happened. And he said, "We were torpedoed." And I said, "What is that?" And he explained that to me. And then I asked him, "Well, why would anybody do that?" And he said, "Hey, stupid, there's a war going on." And I asked him who was fighting. And he told me that, and I said, "Gee, the guy could get hurt over here." And, you know, they took us into England. They picked us up there after a while, took us into England. And they asked me, did I want to get another ship or did I want to get flown home? I didn't like to be hurt. I was scared skinny, but I was more scared of going home. So I said, "I'll take another ship." And they said, "Oh, you're a good boy." So I developed the name Hero, don't you see? And I wasn't a hero. I was drunk 24 hours a day. That's the only way I ever went anywhere, drunk. I couldn't get on a ship otherwise, but I did, drunk. So I used to come home and see my wife on one night and one day, and I would disappear the next morning to Bayonne, New Jersey, and out on a tanker again, all because I didn't want her to see me getting up in the morning. That's how important it was for me not to be an alcoholic. And I fought it. I fought it all the way right to the bottom. Well, the bottom for me was one day coming home on a hospital ship. After being in a coma for 16 days, I had gotten beaten half to death at Marseilles in France. I went into a prisoner of war stockade. I was going to end the war all by myself. And what they did to me was a disgrace. When I woke up, there was a doctor there, and he said, "Don't get excited, kid." He said, "You're almost in New York, and you are going home. I like to kill him." I said, "I'm not going home." And he said, "You have to go home. Because you are sick and you've been hurt very badly." He said, "I had a fractured skull, my jaws are wired together, all my ribs are caved in. I had a broken arm, stitches in every part of my body." And I said, "Give me back my papers, I can't go home." Well, I went home after about 2 months in Oyster Bay, Long Island, where they put crazy semen. Well, I came home to a woman that didn't know me. She didn't know the animal that I had developed into. She was sitting there with her son, my son, and hers, who was only a little baby at the time. And I said to her, "Where's the booze?" And she said, "What booze?" She said, "Jack, I live here by myself. I have only myself and a little one here, and I don't drink. And why do you want booze?" I said, "Well, don't ask any stupid questions. Just go down and get some." So she ran down and got some. And she come back up and thought that was that. And about 3 hours later, she made another trip. And now she knew. And when she knew, I didn't care anymore. Because I told her just one thing. Take that stupid kid. Get out in the street with him or go into the bedroom. He makes too much noise. He bothers me. My nerves can't stand it. And I sat in the corner and I drank 24 hours a day. And I dreamed my dreams. And I was in Never Never Land. And my wife took a look at me and she said, "Jack, you're my husband and I need a husband. You're the father of my boy and I need a father for my boy. I'm going to straighten you out. You're sick." And I said, "You're out of your mind and stay out of my business. Just leave me be." Because now you see, once the secret is out, you don't care anymore who knows or what. I was now drinking desperately in order to stay alive, keep my sanity. Well, she helped me. She went out one day and she shut me off in every bar and every delicatessen for about 10 miles. I walked into my favorite bar about 4 in the afternoon when I usually got up. And I asked for a drink and he almost had a stroke. He said, "Jack, please turn around and walk out of here. You're not getting anything to drink here today." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Your wife was here this morning and she told me that if I give you one drink today, she's going to burn my bar down." So I said, "Well, you're afraid of her, you're stupid." I went to my second favorite bar in the same thing. Make a long story short, I got home about 7 o'clock that evening without a drink, and I was sick. And I said to her, "I'm about to kill you." And she said, "Before you kill me, listen to me. If you want a drink, I'll buy it for you. But do me a favor, come to New York with me." And I thought that one over, and I said, "Is that the only way I'm going to get a drink?" She said, "That's the only way. I'll buy you a drink if you get on the subway and come to New York." Do you know what it is to ride the subway to New York? Well, you could die without drinking, I tell you. It's a horror when you're a normal person. But for an alcoholic to go under the river and sit in a tunnel for 15 minutes, out of this world. But I was so desperate, I agreed. So she bought me a drink, and I said, "Quick, down the subway, let's go." And by the time I got to the other end, it had worn off. And I come out of the subway so bad, she bought me another one. And she said, "Now we are going into that church." And I looked at the church and I said, "Oh no, I'm an Irish Catholic. And that's a Protestant church. I don't go into Protestant churches." And she said, "You dirty bum. You haven't been near any church for 20 years and now you're concerned all of a sudden about it." I went into the church. And it was an AA meeting. And there was some jackass up here like I'm up here tonight, you see. And I sat in the back and I asked her what it was and she said, "This is AA, they're going to help you." I said, "Yeah, I know, like everybody else wants to help me. Stop drinking." I said, "Just watch what happens." Well, the only thing I heard at that meeting that night was this fellow up here, and you know what he said? "Don't take the free drink and you won't get drunk." And I said, "No kidding, yeah?" And I asked my wife, "Did he think that up all by himself?" I mean, he must be a genius, this fellow. And I called him a dirty name in the back of the room. And I told him that if I got close enough to him, I was going to kill him. She got me out of there just before the cops arrived. And I got on the sidewalk and I said, "If you ever do that to me again, I'll bury you and him too. Don't ever do that to me again. Those people are all crazy. They steal a few stamps and they get concerned about it. They said, the white throws them out, and they get concerned. They run and tell you, I'm sick, come back. Not me. I don't need them. I don't need anybody in this world, only me. Just give me back my gun and swing me loose, and I'll be all right. Well, you know, my wife was disgusted with me. And she said, Jack, I don't care if I never see you again. You're hopeless and helpless. And she said, you are just something else. And she left me, and I don't know what happened, how long it was, but when I got back home, it was some days later, and there was two cops in my apartment. Well, you know how cops and me got along. If my hair was on fire and I was laying in the gutter, and there was a cop standing next to me, I wouldn't ask him to spit on me to put the fire out. If there's any here tonight, peace. Peace. It's all in the past. I love you all. I love some better, but I love you too. And these guys were sitting there because I didn't understand why, and I asked them, why are you here? And they said, well, we got some news for you, kid. You almost killed your wife last night. And we've been sitting here waiting for you to come home, and we're going to take you, and it's the last time they're going to do that. And I said, I wasn't even home. And he says, oh, yes, you were. And my wife showed me her neck, it was all black and blue. And I couldn't for the life of me remember what I had done. And she said, Jack, you were fighting Germans or Japs or somebody again. You're crazy. You're going to kill me one day. You're going to kill a baby, too. And I said, no, that's not me. So I told the cops anyway to leave, and they wouldn't. So, you know, I threw them. And they frowned on that in Brooklyn, you know. They didn't like that at all. And they went out and they got reinforcements, and then they threw me, you see. And then for about a year, we were playing King of the Hill with my apartment. And I roamed around the streets of Brooklyn not knowing whether I was going or coming. And it was the worst period of my life. Because I was insane now. My wife didn't want any part of me. Nobody wanted any part of me. And the only thing I would do was to get a hold of a cop and egg him on until he would make a pass at me or me him, and we would go at it. Well, I tell you, they would take me to back in an alley, three or four or five of them, on the back of the station house, and they would wake me over good. And I thought I had lost the sight in one eye. I'm deaf in one ear. My equilibrium was not too good. My jaws have been kicked apart many, many times. In fact, I talk kind of funny sometimes because my jaws have been put back together pretty sad. My teeth up in the roof of my mouth and broken off and stuffed in a straitjacket and put into Kings County Hospital, Bellevue. Well, I tell you, if you never woke up in a straitjacket in a hospital, with your mouth all busted up and your head all stitched up and your ribs caved in, and God only knows how many stitches in your body don't, it's not nice. Because the moment that you open your eyes, you know, you are back to being a 12-year-old scared kid again. And you say, my God, what am I doing here? And you know, it's bad enough to do it one time, but would you believe that I did it 12 times? 12 times. I don't recommend it. And I don't stand here and try and impress you how tough I am. I'm not. I'm not tougher than anybody else in this world. It's just that I'm crazy. When I pick up a drink, I'm insane. And I do things that normally I wouldn't think of doing or being capable of doing. It's my disease at work, don't you see, when I drink. So I would lay in that hospital and I would pray and I would try and keep so quiet so they would take the jacket off me, and at a respectable time they would, and at a respectable time more, they would send me home. And I would go home and I'd be so ashamed and full of remorse that I would wait till it got dark and I would sneak home. And I would walk into a home and my wife would look at me and she'd say, well, Jack, what are you going to do now? And I said, well, I don't know. And I didn't know. And I was so scared and I was so pitiful. And I would sit in a corner and I would tell her, I wouldn't make any noise, just let me sit here, I'm not going to drink, I can't drink no more. And you know, I would sit in a corner and I'm 12 years old, and who the hell needed me? How long could you sit in a corner? And my brother would come, and he was a big, you know, exuberant fellow, and he would say, come on, kid, you come out of hospital now, you're all right. And I'll take you downtown and buy you a job. And I couldn't explain to him that I couldn't get on a subway, and I couldn't fill out a form for a job. I couldn't even speak to people. I was petrified and stuff. And I didn't know. And I was so scared, and I was so pitiful. And I would sit in the corner, and I would tell her, I wouldn't make any noise, just let me sit here, I'm not gonna drink, I can't drink anymore. And you know, I would sit in the corner, and I'm 12 years old, and who the hell needed me? How long could you sit in the corner? And my brother would come, and he was a big, you know, exuberant fellow, and he would say, come on, kid, you come out of hospital now, you're all right, and I'll take you downtown and buy you a job. And I couldn't explain to him that I couldn't get on a subway, and I couldn't fill out a form for a job. I couldn't even speak to people. I was petrified inside. I was just so full of fear that I was just one big blob of fear, that's all it was. If the phone rang, I would jump. Somebody knocked on the door, I was ready to hide under the bed in terror. It was a disease of alcoholism. And I was sure that I was crazy. My sister would come, and she would scream at me. And she would say, my husband is working two jobs to support your family. And you big lazy bum, you sit there and you say you can't work. Well, you see, how long could it go on before I would finally convince my wife that she should give me a dollar? And as God is above me, all I wanted was one drink, just one, so I could take the terror out of my belly. And I could go down and get on a subway or a bus and go to New York or somewhere and get a job or do something, because I couldn't sit in the house for the rest of my life. I couldn't even bear to have the kids walk near me. I was so ashamed and full of terror, it was pitiful. So she would look at me and say, I shouldn't do it, Jack, but I will. So she gave me a dollar all the time, a dollar. She said, please, only one, and come right home tonight. And I would say, only one, and that's as God is above me, that's all that I wanted, one. No more. I didn't want any trouble. And I would go down and have one drink, and it was like somebody turned a key in my head. And all my good intentions went right out the window. And the next thing you know, I'd be looking for that cop that beat on me last week. And I would find him, because all cops have the same face. The next thing you know, I'd be back in the hospital, and I would be half dead again. Waiting and wondering and crying and praying for what's going wrong with me. Why can't I be like other people? And the doctor would come in and he would say, well, you're back again. And I would just look at him with all the hate that I could muster. And I wouldn't dare answer him because he'd keep me in that stupid jacket. And I would just stand there and say, my God, what am I doing to me? And if I ever get out of this place, I'll never ever come back. But like I told you, I came back 12 times. Well, the 12th time was something again. Because two detectives met me and they carried me to a court. And in the court was a judge that knew me. And he said, Jack, we brought you here because we've got to explain something to you. The doctors have given us a prognosis on you. Three very fine doctors. And they've given you 5 years to live. And Jack, they say that if you live 5 years, you'll spend a lot of part in an institution because you're suffering from wet brain. The doctors also say that you're a homicidal maniac. And you might wipe your family out overnight, not even know you did it. And they say it's impossible for you to tell the difference between right and wrong. And they say you'll never ever work another day in your life. And they also recommend that you be removed from your home for the protection of your children. So I looked at my wife, who was standing there, and I said, hey, Roz, is this what you want? And she said, yeah, you bet your life, that's what I want. The children have been awarded to me, and that's the end of that. And I'm going to raise them. And you get out of our lives because you have never done anything but hurt us since the moment that we ever got together. You have never done anything but hate everyone you come in contact with. Get out of our lives and leave us. And if you come back, I'm going to kill you. Now, this woman was a very naive, gentle woman. And I had made a monster out of her. And I looked at her and I could see a different person. She was so full of venom and hate that it was astounding. And I just looked at her and I said, "You can't mean that." She said, "I do." She said, "I'll get you while you're sleeping one night if you come back. And I'll stick a knife in your belly and they won't do a thing to me because somebody should have done it a long time ago." So they threw me out of that court that day and they put me on a subway for free, right over the turnstile. And they said, "Don't come back to Brooklyn, bum. We had enough for you." So I went to New York and I was going to go down to Mulberry Street and I was going to get a gun and I was going to do a lot of things. No, it don't work that way. This is the way that the alcoholic dreams that it's going to work. Tomorrow will be all right. Tomorrow will be better. No, tomorrow is worse. Because I never made Mulberry Street. I made the other side of Canal and I lived on the Bowery in New York for about 2.5 years. And I lived in the snow and in the rain. I never remember eating, shaving, bathing, nothing. And I do remember waking up and finding myself full of blood. And I would have holes in my head and my skull would be split. My mouth would be busted and somebody would say that I'd fallen down the subway stairs or something, or get hit with a cab or a bus. Only thing I remember actually is the hate that I had. I was so full of hate that it was pitiful. And I used to live and I used to breathe hate. I hated my mother, my father, my sisters, my brothers, my wife, my children, and I cursed God every time that I opened my eyes. You know, I used to lay on a Bowery and I would say to myself, if I just shut my eyes a little bit, maybe it's only a bad dream, because before I opened my eyes, I could smell myself. I was filthy with body lice. I had no shoes. I had no clothes. I had nothing. Hair hung down the back of my neck. I was a mass of nothing. And I would lay there and smell myself, and I would say, "No, it can't be." And you know how it is when you're a kid. You used to close your eyes, and you'd wake up again, and you'd find that it was all a bad dream. I tried to do that. But every time I woke up, I was still there. And it was me that I was smelling, and then the hate would set in. Well, to make a long story short, I always say that, and I don't, but I tried. I woke up one day, and I had a bottle, and I tried to drink it. And I had hemorrhage in the stomach. And I was in a dirty toilet on a Bowery in New York, and I fell on my hands and knees. I couldn't stand up. And I literally watched myself running down a toilet bowl. Every time I breathed, I bled. And I was so weak, I couldn't move. And it was at that moment that I looked at the bottle and I said, "To hell with it, and why do I fight so bad?" And I threw the bottle over my shoulder and I got ready to die. I knew that it was coming. But you see, for the first time in my life, I put my finger on the trouble. I put my finger on the bottle and I said, "It has to be. That's the cause of my trouble." And you know, I lay there for I don't know how long. But no prayer that's uttered in despair goes unanswered. And it was while I was laying there, I began to get a very rapid fire collection of pictures going flashing through my mind. And I saw my wife, and I saw my mother before she died, and I saw a lot of strange things. Fairly nice things, and some bad things, but all good things mostly. And then one picture I got was a picture of that AA meeting I had been to, where that lad had said, "Don't take the first drink and you won't get drunk." And it was like I was sitting up in one of the chandeliers looking down at all these people. And I could see them walking about and milling about and drinking their coffee and the clean clothes they had. And suddenly I knew. And I remember what a revelation it was to me. And I said, "Jack, you know something, you're a damn fool. You had it and you blew it. That was the answer. And why didn't you listen?" And I remember almost crying, and I said, "Why didn't I listen?" And then suddenly a thought came to me that maybe it wasn't too late. And I said, "Oh my God, if only I could go to AA now." Well, somehow I crawled out of that filthy dump that I was in. And I got out onto the sidewalk somewhere and I made somebody understand what I wanted. I don't know to this minute who that it was. But I remember screaming at somebody. And I remember the trouble that I had making them understand what I wanted, because my mouth was all busted up and my throat was infected and I couldn't speak too good. I could barely see out of either eye. And I must have been an apparition, like a madman, trying to get somebody to call AA for me. But somewhere out there, there was somebody that did. And I remember them coming back and telling me, all right, we called them, now sit down and don't get lost. You see, because the alcoholic on the Bowery is in another world. His mind may be here and his body goes there. He don't know the difference. He's very disjointed, disconnected. So I remember what it was, sitting and waiting. And I said, they're coming, and I have to sit here. And I was so mentally sick. My mind was so badly affected that I had to keep that one thought in my mind all the time. They're coming, don't move, stay here, the man said so. And I remember then I started to debate with myself whether or not that was a dream that they were coming, or maybe I had just dreamed it. So I sat there in Never Land waiting for my sponsor to come. And my sponsor came. Now, I'm a big Irish Catholic, you see. And I hate minority groups, at least I did. And if you were anything but an Irish Catholic and I stuck you up, I wouldn't even give you car fare. You didn't count in this world, nothing. There was nobody but Irish Catholics. And yet now here I was, almost at death's door. No cop would even lock me up. My brothers were afraid to come near me. My father was deadly afraid of me. My sisters disowned me. My wife wouldn't have any part of me. And yet my sponsor came and he stood in front of me. And he said, my name is Sam Cohen and I'm here to help you. A wonderful, beautiful little Jewish fellow. And he had his wife with him and she couldn't stop gasping. She kept saying, oh my God, oh my God. And finally he said to her, Gene, it's all right. And he said to me, if you want to stop drinking, I said, that's the only thing that I want in this world. And he got up real close to me, you see, to hear what I was saying, because I couldn't talk too good. And I looked into his eyes, and that's what I wanted. He understood me. And I said to him, I don't know what you could do for me, but I hope you could help me. And he said, that's why I came. And he said, I want to tell you something now. If you come with me and Jean, you'll be all right and you don't have to drink no more. Now, either he was the biggest idiot that walked the face of this earth, or he was the smartest and most kind man you ever met. He had to be one or the other, because three doctors had said 5 years at the most, and I was pushing six. And yet this guy looked at me, and without a second thought, you come with me and Jean, and you don't have to drink no more. And you'll be all right. And you know something? The look in his eyes, I believed him. So when I stand up here and say that my name is Jack Brennan, I'm an alcoholic, and that I believe that this is a God-given and God-inspired program, that's exactly what I mean. I don't mean maybe or perhaps. I know. I know with all my heart that there is no other way that I could be alive here tonight and talk to you people. And I'm not only one miracle. There are some 600,000 of us. Some may be a little more miracle than others, but all of us miracles. Because anything that happened to me could conceivably happen to you given enough time and booze. Because this AA program or this AA disease that we have, this alcoholism that we have, is like a long, slow train ride that goes from wall to wall. And if you persist and stay on the train, you're going to wind up at the wall, period. The last stop, as I did. But if you decide to get off halfway, that's to your benefit. You are just as much an alcoholic as I am. In fact, if everybody had to go to the wall at last stop, I don't think I would want to belong to this program. So AA does work for everybody that comes in. And it will work for me and it will work for you. And I used to look down my nose at martini drinkers. Until my sponsor one day said, what's wrong with you, big shot?
You know how many ounces of alcohol are in a martini? I said, no. He said, 3. I almost fell off my stool. I developed a new respect for martini drinkers because I only drank 1 shot, 1 ounce at a time. So you see, it's not what we take in the way of alcohol, what the alcohol does to us. I decided that day I wanted what my friend Sam Cullen offered me. And I went to AA. And I went to AA on the arm of this little Jewish fellow and his wife. And God rest him, he's dead now. He died 2 weeks before Bill Wilson did. But that man taught me everything that I know. He taught me about love, and he taught me about affection, and he taught me about what's right and what's wrong. He taught me about my higher power, who I feared very greatly. He taught me everything. He was a fine, fine man. And when they tell you here in AA that there is no religion, you had best believe it, because there is no religion in AA. There is a spiritual side to our program. But you see, the AA program causes us to be spiritual. It makes us and brings us to the point where people, we learn to love us and want us and need us. And then we become spiritual. I came to AA and I would have suffered for 3 months. If I could have made 3 months, I would have gladly died and been buried. Because to me, 3 months was the end of the world. If I could make 3 months sober, I would have made it. But you see, my friend always has the last word. I don't go 1 minute before I'm wanted. And I don't stay 1 minute after I'm wanted. Now, I don't like to say it, but those 3 doctors that gave me 5 years to live, almost 30 years ago, well, 2 of them are dead. And the 3rd guy, he's not doing too good, I tell you. He's not doing well at all. And every time I see him, I tell him, take care of himself. And there are normal people out there, they need him. And he looks at me and he laughs. He says, I know, you're a miracle. And I say, that's right, Doc. And I love that man because he is one person that knows me so well. But you see, I came into AA expecting nothing. And I got the whole world back right in my hand. My life was given back to me. And people will say, you happy fellow. And I say, you bet your life I'm happy. Because you see, I came to AA over 25 years ago. 25 long years I've had to put my life back together and get to know people and learn to love people and learn to love myself too in order to be able to love you. But it wasn't easy for me. I couldn't hardly speak. I couldn't speak. I couldn't talk. I couldn't see too well. I had no clothes, no job, unemployable. But I managed. And I would say right here that if I can do it, anybody can do it. And that's the point of this whole thing, you see. Example. Some poor guy sitting out there wondering who you are and where you're going. You can do exactly as I did if you have the mind to. All you must do as I did. Come into AA, put your whole heart and whole soul into it, and turn your life and will over to the care of God as you understand Him. The rest of it is just drinking coffee, making friends, and going to meetings. Your whole life will be taken care of, same as mine was. You see, I came to AA hoping for 3 months, as I said. And little by little, I began to get on my feet, and I began to have enough health back in me so I could get a job washing dishes. And finally, I got myself a little room. I was able to buy myself a pair of pants and a pair of shoes. And I thought I had the world with it. I was so happy. Because you see, when I came to AA, I found what I was looking for in the bottom of a bottle for so many years. Understanding. Nobody ever said to me, get that bum out of here, he stinks too bad, no? They said, sit down, have a cup of coffee, and please come back. We need you. You see, immediately, they needed me. And I couldn't understand it. And I asked him, well, why did they need me? Because, Jack, they need you, but when they look at you, they know how fortunate they are. And I bought that.
And then he said, you know, you're very useful around here. You've helped an awful lot of people. And I said, how do you figure that? He said, well, we always sit our newcomers next to you. And we tell them to watch you. Good. And if they keep drinking, they'll get like you. And I thought that was delightful, you know. I like that. Oh, I said, that's good. You see, so I was wanted, and I was needed. And then one day, Sam Cohen said to me, I could wash the dishes. We had very lovely china cups. And 2 weeks after I started washing dishes, they got paper cups. Because I broke them all, you see. But it didn't make any difference. They loved me. And one night, Sam Cohen told me, he says, Jack, I love you. And I looked at him kind of funny. I said, what the hell kind of way is that to talk, Sam? You know, you are a man. You know, you don't talk to me like that. I never thought that there was anything wrong with you. And he said, Jack, no. He said, no, not what you think. He said, we love you because you're an alcoholic. I want you to think that over good. Especially people out there that, you know, feel kind of upset and left alone. We love you because you're an alcoholic. Who in God's name ever loved you before AA because you were an alcoholic? Isn't it the question not of loving you because you're an alcoholic, but isn't it the way that people used to tolerate you, even your own family? They'd love you in spite of you being an alcoholic, but nobody ever loved you because you were one until you got here. And that's the way that was with me, so I began to appreciate things very good. I was in AA for about 2.5 years. My wife came to me, and I told Sam, I said, keep an eye on her. She's up to no good. I don't know what it is, but she's up to it. And he said, Jack, let me talk with her. So he talked with her. And he came back, he said, you wrong. I said, no, I'm not wrong. I know that woman. I know her good. She's up to something. I was scared of her. She came over, she spoke to me. She said, I'm so happy you're sober. I said, yeah, why? And she just said, well, because I'm happy you're sober. And I said, good. If that's all you want, leave. And you see, and this is the animal. This is the animal that the alcoholic become. Trust nobody. A little by little, she kept coming back, and she assured me, and no designs on me whatsoever, nothing. And then one day she said to me, you know, we're having a hard time home living around welfare. You pay rent for a room. Would you like to come home and sleep on a couch in the living room? And I said, sure, that'd be all right. Because I did want to help her out with the kids, you know. I wasn't making much money, just enough to buy a room and eat with. So I went home, and it was another period of my life. I slept on a couch in the living room, and I was very happy. So I was always happy. I didn't want too much, just a little bit. I didn't want the whole apple, I just want a little bit of the core. And I got it. I could watch the kids go to school now. And I thought it was great. And then one day she said to me, isn't that couch getting a little hard? And I said, no. Now you can see what alcohol will do to you. And finally she made it very clear. She had making improper advances to me. And finally I went up to the Holy Mountain and I spoke to a monk up there. And I said, my wife is making a noise like a wife again. And he said, that's good. Go home. That's good. I said, how the hell do you know it's good? You're a monk. And he said, I tell you it's right. Go home. So I never figured that one out, but I went home anyway. And I was scared. Oh, was I scared. See, I was a big fella, but I was now first growing up from that 12-year-old scared kid. I was an old man, actually, but now I had to learn how to live all over again. And then I began to understand what they say when they say it's a new way of life. It's not just a matter of being sober. If I was just sober, I'd rather be drunk. So I started to grow, and my wife helped me so much. Everything that I did, she was there. She taught me how to speak in front of a mirror down the basement when the kids went to bed. My daughter taught me how to hold a knife and a fork. Quote, my hand had been very badly injured, and I couldn't. I dropped the stroke all the time. And she'd take a little hand and hold it on top of me, and she'd say, come on, Pop, you can do it. Hold it tight. And I would hold it and throw meat with it, don't you see? Well, it worked. And my son, my older boy there, he used to follow me around and pick up my glasses for me and keep putting them back in my pocket because my mind was gone. Very forgetful, very stupid, but very happy. I was home again. I was a man again. I was a husband, and I was a father. The cycle had come complete, I thought. But my friend upstairs, a very magnificent fellow, and if you ain't on his side, or you don't believe that you can be, you best think again. Because I was in AA for a couple of years like that with my wife, and I put the guy out of the gutter one night and took him home. He had no place to stay. And my wife was of a different religion than I was. And I couldn't go to church very well because you know how it is. And my children weren't baptized. And you know something? This guy I picked out of the gutter and took him home to live with me turned out to be a very, very fine lad. He had studied to be a priest years previous. And my wife looked at him and me running about together, you know. And she started asking questions. Next thing you know, she went up to church. She was converted. And then my two kids were baptized on the same altar I was married on the Saturday morning. And that Saturday night, I went to my AA meeting in the basement in that same church. So you see, all my impossible things became easy. Because one night I had said to Sam Cohn, Sam, I owe you my life. He said, you're crazy. You owe me nothing. You're an idiot. You're stupid. The doctors were right. You got a wet brain. He was a nasty little Jew. Ooh. And I said, Sam, don't talk to me like you hurt me. And he said, I wish I could hurt you. A little bigger, I would. He said, you owe everything to the higher power, not me. He said, he sent me out to get you, you stupid thing. He must love you pretty good. And you know, he said, what I did for you was done for me, so we're even. Guy that did it for me had it done for him. Carried all the way back to the first, Bill Wilson got it from the higher power. So he said, if you want to turn your life a little over to him, you go ahead and talk to him. Talk to him just like you talk to me. And then he thought it over me. He said, no, you better clean up a little bit first. So that night I did. I went outside and I told my friend upstairs, you know, I said, I ain't doing too good till now. Not too good. Hurt a lot of people, did a lot of nasty things, but you know, I'm an alcoholic. You know that because you brought me to AA. I said, but from here on in, if you tell me what to do, I'll do it. No questions asked, I'll do it. I want to thank you for what I got so far. And I said, I am just so happy. Please help me. And he's helped me ever since. He's told me what to do. And a lot of times, you know, I look at him, I see situations, and I say, no, that's not right. You're making a boo-boo, friend. And, you know, I said, but that's not, I'll do it. But I don't think it's right. And if you get any trouble, don't blame me. So I do what I know is wrong, and it comes out right. Then I say, well, go ahead, laugh. After all, that's why you're up there and I'm here. I'm only human. But I've learned over the years, I trust him implicitly. I have enough faith for everybody in this room, any room, because mine eyes have watched miracles. I know this is a God-given guidance by a program. You see, I had two children, now I have three. I was in AA about 5 years, and my wife gave birth to a gay child, a boy. He's my AA baby, 19 years old, and he goes to Haverford College in Pennsylvania, a little small Quaker college. And he's a beautiful boy, very gentle, very kind, very considerate, and he's also a genius. He came out in the National Merit Scholarship competitions, the top 0.5% in the whole country. This is what AA will do. If there's anybody here that thinks AA don't work, you're wrong. AA does work. I'm here to tell you that it does. I'll prove it again. Because you see, my older boy graduated from school and went to the Marine Corps. And one day two MPs came to the door and he said, we're looking for Joseph Brennan. And she said, he's in Paris Island, my wife. And she called me on a job. I come home and said, what's wrong? That kid hasn't been on the base for 2 months. I said, it's impossible. You see, my father was an alcoholic, and my son, I'm an alcoholic, and my son is an alcoholic. And for 12 long years, he knocked his brains out. And my wife said the same thing that my mother said. Not two in one family. And I said, yeah, two in one family, Roz, you better accept it. Now, why does your friend do this to me, Jack? I said, I don't know. I don't know, but it's here. You best learn to live with it. And I said, he has his reasons for everything that he does. So you see, my wife was torn with this beautiful young boy and my beautiful daughter and this alcoholic son, beautiful but alcoholic. And she said, why can't we live just so nicely? First to have you, and I got to go through the whole thing over with him. And God bless her, she did. Because we have gone to visit him in the state prison. You're doing a year and a day flat. And you know what it is for me to go and watch my son behind bars. It's not easy. And to go into a Bowery and see him laying in the same gutters that I was laying in and have him tell me, Pop, I'm glad I'm not like you. I can think you can. There are some so blind that they can't see. And some can't see because they refuse to. Well, to make a long story short, I'm going to get the hell out of here right now because I know everybody's getting nervous. On last December, my wife and I had a very beautiful Christmas. My son, who never came near the house for 6 years, all we heard of him was police calls here and there, terrible tragedies in his life. But he called up on about 20th of December. He said, Pop, I'm in Rochester, New York. I'm at the end of my rope. I can't go no further. He says, I've got a wife and I've got a baby. He says, I want to come home. I want to go to AA. And I said, good. Come on home. He said, don't have any money. I sent the money. Came home on a bus the next day. And my son came home from college. My daughter came home from Syracuse with her baby. And we had a beautiful day. Oh, it was a lovely Christmas. A whole week of nothing going wrong. Beautiful. And then he went home to their respective homes, and my wife and I sat, and we just gloried in AA and higher power. And we talked so good, she said, I'll never doubt him again. I said, good. Now you know how I feel. And you know, we just so glad to be alive. And we had nobody home but just me and her and the dog. And yet we felt so good. Well, I was to go to Midland, Texas on the 22nd of January. And my son was going to AA, everything was fine. And on Tuesday of that week, 22nd was on a Friday, I believe. Anyway, I had tickets to leave on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday come back. And, you know, on Tuesday I got very upset. And I couldn't figure it out. I went home, I called my wife. I don't feel right. I said, I feel like, you know, something's bad. And she said, oh, it's your nonsense. You know, it's your disease showing. And I said, maybe. Wednesday was worse, and Thursday was even worse. It was so bad that I went to the airport to change my tickets. And I came home Thursday night, Friday morning rather, and I told her, I said, I'm not going Friday morning. I said, I changed it to Saturday. She said, you shouldn't have done that. You're very tired. You've been working very hard. You need to rest. All your friends in Texas want to see you. I said, I'm going Saturday, and that's that, period. Well, Friday night, I went to bed, and I was extremely upset. And my wife looked at me, and she said, Jack, you know, I only wish to God that there was something I could do for you. You look so terribly unhappy. And I said, I am. And I don't know why, so just go to bed, please, and leave me be. I'll be all right. I'll read my book for a little while. I'll be all right. So I read my book for a half hour, my little Bible, and tried to calm myself down, and I fell into a very fitful sleep. And about 1:30, she woke me up, and she said, Jack, I'm having trouble. I can't breathe. And, you know, I took her downstairs, and I helped her breathe till the ambulance got there. And I put her in the ambulance, and I followed the ambulance to the hospital in a car. And I never seen her again alive. 5 o'clock that morning, she was dead.
Now, we buried her properly up there in the little town where I live, and I go to see her once in a while. And I'm not unhappy. I'm lonesome, but I'm not unhappy. You see, because when I came out of that hospital, that particular morning, I had no shade on. I had it in a hurry. It was January 22. It was bitter cold in New York. And I stood there in the parking lot, and there was no lights, and it was dark, and it was cold. And I asked my friend upstairs, I said, what do you do to me? And, you know, I was a little upset, and I just couldn't figure it out. I wasn't upset where I would be wild, but just upset inside. I just didn't understand. I said, why would you do that to me now? Now that everything is good and we're first starting to live, and now she's dead. And I told him, I said, when I bury her, I'll go bury her for me. How am I ever going to get along without her? Because everything I did, she helped me with. I couldn't even book a meeting without her. And I couldn't answer phone without her. I said, what am I going to do now? Well, you know, the answer came to me there in that yard, in that hospital yard. The answer came to me that it could have been quite different. It could have been that I had died on the Bowery and never knew this woman again. It could have been that I never had a third son. And suddenly it dawned on me, I was giving back my life and my wife and my children, and I had them for 25 long years, where I was able to make a new life for me and prove to them that I did love them and that I was a father and a husband. And she died extremely happy, and I tell you, there's nobody ever going to get out of this world alive, and if I have to go, I hope that I go exactly the same way. So you see, I don't fear death, and I don't fear life. I fear nothing anymore, because I realize how good my friend upstairs is to me, a sick alcoholic. So that day I knew what my answer was. And I jumped in the car, and I didn't go home. I went right down to Pennsylvania, and I picked up my son. And I said, John, we got a problem. He says, I know. I could tell by your face. And he said, well, that's all right, Pop. He said, she's up there now, and she's directing the old friend upstairs, telling them what to do. And he says, you got an open line right now to the higher power. So now I look at my son, I see my wife. I look at my son, and I see God. I look at you, see you people, and I see love. I'm the richest man in this world. I have everything that I need. I have everything that I could possibly need. Not everything that I want, but everything that I need. I live well. I sleep well. Because I have peace in my heart. I don't know what serenity is, but peace I have in my heart. Because I know that each day when I get up, I say my little prayer. And those yellow cards on both ends are my little prayer. And if you'd like to join me tomorrow, do. Because, you see, each day that I get up, I must remember my name is Jack Brennan. I'm an alcoholic. And I must point myself in the right direction. And when I get up in the morning, I don't do anything until I say my little prayer. It's called secret. I meet my God in the morning when my day is at its best. And His presence comes like sunrise, like a glory in my breast. All day long, His presence lingers, and all day long, He stays with me. And we sail in perfect calmness over every troubled sea. So I think I know the secret link for many a troubled way. You must seek Him in the morning if you want Him throughout the day. There's no more than I can tell you. I'm very happy to be here. I wish you all love, and I wish you all everything that the higher power has in store for you. And I would remind you too, that if I can do it, you can do it too. And I'd like to leave you all with a little blessing that I love so well. May the roads rise with you. May the wind always be at your back. May the sun gently warm your face and the rain softly fall on your fields. And until we meet again, may the good Lord hold us all in the hollow of His hand. Thank you, and God bless you.